So we're delving into the topic of byproducts in agriculture that then become value-added products in this episode of The Business of Agriculture. Hey, Damian Mason here with a question before we hop into this episode of The Business of Agriculture. If you farm for a living, you employ a lot of amazing technology, from your inputs that you put into the soil to the tractor that you sit in, your combine, and the amazing data that it harvests. But has your soil analytics kept up technologically with everything else in your farming operation? I would venture to say that no, it is not. Sure, you check for your nitrogen, your phosphorus, your potassium, your micronutrients as well. But what about disease pressure? Do you know what diseases and what pests you're going to face next year? No, you don't. But you can now figure that out with Pattern Ag's predictive analytics. Think about it. They can tell you now with testing what the likelihood of facing nasty diseases, things like cyst nematode or sudden death syndrome, what the likelihood of you having this in your field. Then you know how to prepare, how to treat, and where to invest your money. It's using technology to make you bigger yields and therefore make you bigger money. Go to www.pattern.ag to learn more. They are pioneering the way in predictive agronomy. Hey there, thanks for joining us for another fantastic episode of The Business of Agriculture. We're talking today to Rich Troyer. He is the CEO of a company called Comet Bio. Comet Bio came on my radar because some work I've done with Open Prairie. You've heard me talk about them before. They're an investment company out of Effingham, Illinois. Venture capital slash private equity, if you will, that puts money into agricultural enterprises. We're going to hear all about Comet Bio, but what's kind of neat to me is essentially they're taking a byproduct. Wheat straw is a good example, and making it a human food ingredient product. You're talking about value added. You're talking about something that used to just be baled up and thrown out for the cows to poop in. And now we're actually taking something and adding value to it. So there's a lot of promise in this realm. And I want to hear all about it. And you're going to hear all about it from Rich Troyer. Mr. Troyer, did I do you justice when I just talked about what Comet Bio does in a nutshell? Because I know that you've got to give me the corporate deal. So go ahead and give it to me. What do you do and how bad was I off?
No, you got it pretty right, Damian. So the way we like to describe ourselves is we're a technology-enabled food ingredients company. And what we do is, you know, we work with farmers. We extract nutrients. And in this case, we're talking about a dietary fiber from basically the parts of the crop that would typically be left in the field or would be harvested for other uses. Today, we're processing wheat straw and we're extracting a dietary fiber called arabinoxylan, and that is used by our customers, you know, incorporated into foods that you may know very well, where they want to really add fiber content or nutrition to existing products.
Okay, so let's start with that. So I go to your website, which is comet-bio, I believe.
Yep. Comet-bio, yep.
Okay, comet-bio. I said hyphen, you said dash. And we're not going to disagree on vernacular here. You said, it's a fiber, but fiber could come from a whole bunch of sources. Is it the fiber that you're after or is there something else? Because hell, you can get fiber from prairie grass, you can get fiber from all sorts of things. Why wheat? Is it? I'm guessing it's because it's so commonly cultivated, but is there something else?
Yeah, so arabinoxylan, it's a naturally occurring dietary.
Wait, now say it again. You said it, arabinoxylan. I'm thinking this is a place like on ABC where bachelors go and try and, you know, get married on a reality show. Arabinoxylan, is that what you're calling it?
Arabinoxylan.
Arabinoxylan.
Yep.
I'm not a chemistry major. Full disclosure here, ag econ. So what is arabinoxylan?
So it's a naturally occurring, it doesn't sound like it by the name, but it's a naturally occurring dietary fiber. It's actually the most prevalent, and this kind of gets to your question, it's the most prevalent dietary fiber in whole grains. And a lot of people haven't heard about it because it's not something you can go out and buy today. So when people tell you eat your whole grains, it's good for you. A lot of that is because of the dietary fiber, as I think most people know. Arabinoxylan, and our branded product is called Arabina, which is probably easier. It's the most prevalent dietary fiber in whole grains. The other dietary fiber that's prevalent in whole grains is beta-glucan, which I think a lot of people have heard of because it's got really proven health benefits, and you can actually go out and buy beta-glucan separately. So it's a different dietary fiber. You're right, there are a lot of different dietary fibers, but they all offer different things. So for us, it's about the diversity of dietary fibers people get. And we think ours is nature's best dietary fiber is what we like to call it. And I think for good reason.
Yeah. Okay. So Arabinha is a branded product name. Arabinoxylin is a type of fiber, the most commonly, I think you said, found fiber in plants, period, or in like cereal grain plants?
Yeah, cereal grain. So it's the most common for in whole wheat, for example, if you're getting or oats, if you're getting your dietary fiber from those products, you're getting a lot of arabinoxylin. Okay. You just might not know. And so that's why we use wheat straw, because it's most prevalent in the grains or the husks, but it's also prevalent in the stalks of the plants. And obviously that's something that's not typically eaten by humans. So what we do is we take those stalks or the wheat straw, and then we simply extract the arabinoxylin, and then you've got some pretty interesting other products that are still left. That our partners use for various purposes. So we take, you know, the really interesting dietary fiber, and then the rest kind of goes down the line.
Yeah, I want to hear about the downstream stuff after you, but let's stick on you because this is cool. You're already taking stuff that, and like you said, it would be blown back onto the field. You know, we don't grow a lot of wheat where you are. You're in Illinois, in Indiana. Yeah. We don't really move the wheat market. About 47 million wheat acres in the United States, last time I looked at some USDA stats. And obviously there's other countries that are far bigger players than us. But the thing here is it's the third most cultivated crop in America, maybe even globally, but maybe higher than that globally. But the thing is, there's a bunch of this stuff available. And you said, it's got this fiber and we can use it. But is it because it's a dietary supplement or is it because it binds stuff together? In other words, did we need this kind of a fiber before, or is the thing that it's needed for fiber for something, you know, to make us poop, to make our health? Or is it that it's always been needed as a food ingredient to bind it together, to hold it, to give it structures or something like that? Is this a new thing?
Yeah, you know, and you're gonna love this answer. It depends on the application, right? So it's not all about regularity. A lot of people think that about dietary fiber. Folks are eating a lot more dietary fiber for general health benefits. So if you think about kind of where arabinoxylin is useful, we have some proven what we call structure function claims kind of on the health side. So when you think about supplements, we grow the beneficial bacteria in the gut, arabinoxylin does. So it's a good gut health product. And also it supports healthy metabolism. So when you eat food, your blood sugar spikes. Our product and a lot of other dietary fibers stabilize that blood sugar spike. So on the health side, it's very important. But then also when you think about functionality and binding of foods.
Yeah.
There's a huge trend, as you probably know, in sugar reduction. If you take out sugar, you're taking out a lot of the product that binds foods. So you need something to provide bulk, and dietary fiber does that as well. So arabinoxylin, we've tested in a whole bunch of different applications, and it works really from the very kind of blocking and tackling, relatively low value functionality, adding bulk. All the way up to providing really important health benefits to consumers. So it really depends on the product you're looking at and what our customers are trying to do. If you're taking out sugar, we have a really good solution for helping you do that.
Yeah, so this might be tying into a trend. I mean, it was about a decade ago, the documentary by Katie Couric, it had Bill Clinton in it. It was all about the obesity epidemic and how it was food companies went away from fat because the low fat, I mean, they were not giving it the credit they should, went to more sugar in the processed foods because when you removed fat, it made food less good. And then we had the sugar. Now there's this move that I think is probably smart to take sugars away. And that's where your product can help not add sweetness, but add structure or binding, right?
Correct. It does have a little bit of sweetness to it, but it's not anywhere close to like a one-to-one swap. It's mostly about providing that mouthfeel and bulking when people take out the sugar.
By the way, Food Science 161, the only food science class I ever took, because I thought it was really cool, talked about mouthfeel. And that's something that I explain it to some folks, and they think it's a term that I have made up. You just used it. And it's very important in food science, because people always say, oh, I don't like this. It must be a texture thing. There's a big thing about food manufacturing, food processing, that it doesn't have this weird thing that happens. So kind of touch on, and then the other thing you said, bulking. So give me the thought on that.
How you're processing. So on the mouthfeel, one of the applications we've tested this in, and we're working with partners to commercialize this, is they tested it in plant-based chocolate milk. And everybody can have different views on plant-based foods, et cetera, but it does tend to be a little bit chalky. It feels like it's missing something. And what they said is their food, you know, they all have these panels of tasters, and they said this almost tastes more now like a whole milk-based chocolate milk, because there is something missing. It makes it a little bit, the Ravenel's Island makes it a little bit creamier. So that's the really, really heavy science.
It's not that heavy a science. You didn't get into like, you know, chemical diagrams. You just talked about that. And by the way, what you didn't probably realize, Mr. Troyer, coming on here, dairy farm boy, I drink whole chocolate milk, the cow kind, not that plant-based shit. Yep. Every morning of my life, I drink real chocolate milk of the whole milk variety because of the creaminess and because of the mouthfeel, and also because it makes me happy and it fills me up. Now, since we're all in business, and that was me, just my commentary, I think it's brilliant that your product can take a plant-based milk, let's say, which is not really milk, and add that thing, because that's always been the mouthfeel component, the non-real stuff, where there's fake meat, fake milk, whatever, it misses the fat component, which means it misses the fat taste, satiation, and feel, right?
Yep, exactly. And so again, it's not, you know, we don't have a dog in that fight around plant-based proteins, et cetera. You know, we work with customers, all different kinds of customers, to kind of help fill their gaps. And on the bulking side, really what I was talking about is, you know, if you take sugar out of a product, that I won't get too technical about it because I'm not a food scientist, you take a bunch of sugar out, you've got less there. So you need to replace it with something. And what they'll often do is put in a high intensity sweetener, but that doesn't take up any room. So you need to put something else in there. So we really enable sugar reduction. And what you're doing is you're making it healthier with less sugar, but you're also adding dietary fiber. So it's kind of a two for one. Reduce sugar, increase dietary content. Because as you said, as food gets more processed, we're taking out a lot of the really good stuff that you get if you just ate whole grains that the farmers grow. You know, a lot of that's kind of going to waste, frankly.
Tell me a little bit then, where do I find, granted, I'm not going to come and buy your stuff. Comet Bio is not a consumer brand or even a direct-to-consumer company. You're one to five layers, I'm guessing, between, you know, my dinner plate and you. Where does it go?
So we just started up our first commercial plant in Denmark. It will go. And so our first partner is in the process of launching their product. And it's actually chocolate. It's a chocolate bar. Real chocolate.
Okay.
It's actually delicious. It's milk chocolate. Really delicious stuff. And what they wanted to do was to have the product taste exactly the same, a little bit less sugar, and have some health benefits to it. I mean, chocolate is, you know, in a lot of ways already pretty good for you, but add some fiber and you literally cannot tell it's there. And so it's just a way to, you know, keep eating the same stuff, but get a little bit more nutrition in what you would otherwise eat. So we're really excited about that application. That's going to be our first application. This product works incredibly well in beverages. It's highly soluble. So again, you know, you may have seen carbonated beverages that have dietary fiber in them. Mm-hmm. It's the same stuff you drink otherwise, tastes exactly the same, but you're getting that dietary fiber. So it's really about making convenient foods healthier. That's kind of our primary goal.
What's interesting and neat, obviously, all at the same time, is that you said our first, you're a new company. I mean, you haven't been working with Nestle or, you know, Unilever or, you know, name the, you know, Nabisco or whatever for the last 50 years. You've been, your company is a couple of years in. Yeah.
Well, you know, say we're a new company. Our founders actually brought in our first investors in 2015. So yes, in the grand scheme of things, we're a relatively new company, but this takes time. And I think that's one of the things that people really need to realize, you know, when they think about startups, is a lot of these startups take a lot of time. So it's been 8 years and we're now commercial. But in the grand scheme of things, yeah, we're a new, relatively young company.
Got it. Hey, we're going to ask a whole bunch of questions to Mr. Troy here. I want to know about where they source their stuff. I want to hear about where it goes after them. We got so much stuff to delve into. This is a great new angle on agriculture, in my opinion, and it's using a product that we already have and finding new uses for it, which is something we always talk a lot about in agriculture. Before I do that, I want to ask you, dear listener and viewer, do you spend time looking for answers to problems you have? The answer is yes, you do. I already answered that for you. My buddy, Rob Syk, who's been on my podcast a number of times, is an agricultural entrepreneur. He started a company called AgVisor Pro. I'm wearing the hat right now. AgVisor Pro is an app. You put it on your phone. You carry this with you everywhere you go. You use this for hours a day. You know what? Are you using it to your best benefit? If you are in agriculture and you look for answers to problems that you have, put the AgVisor Pro app on your phone. It don't cost nothing. And you put it on there. And instead of going on Ag Twitter and getting all the peanut gallery ridiculing you for having a question, you go on and talk to actually ag professionals who know a lot about stuff. There's even communities within AgVisor Pro. So think about it. Within AgVisor Pro, there's a community of alfalfa producers, a community of barley experts, agronomists, whatever. So within AgVisor Pro, there are communities of experts. You can ask questions. You can also become an expert. And then all of a sudden, you could strike a relationship where people pay you for your expertise. It's called AgVisor Pro. It's an app. Put it on your phone. It'll help you save time. And as my buddy Rob says, if you shorten time and distance, you make more money. He's giving you an option to shorten time and distance. There you go. AgVisor Pro. All right. The product that you have is now going to go in this chocolate. That's the first big thing. Where did you, if you now just have a customer, for 8 years, you've been hanging around looking for this to take off. Why did your guys start the company? A lot of times you start a company because someone comes to you and says, hey, you're doing this. If you could do that, I would become a customer. 8 years just on a whim? Or was that where? Tell me the genesis.
Not on a whim.
Decided to take straw out of a field and turn it into a food product.
Yes. Yeah, so our founders worked at a company, 20 plus years ago called Steak Technologies. And they were working on a technology. Basically, you take, they were looking at various feedstocks, including a corn stover, and basically trying to make it more digestible for farm animals. So they were advancing technology. What you do is you put the corn stover or other feedstock into the system. Basically, you steam explode it, you open up the cellulose, the other nutrients, and so animals can eat it and it's more readily available. So that was the application that they were originally looking at.
And makes the product more digestible. Is that the angle?
Farm animals, correct. So, and the economics of that were, you know, interesting, but not necessarily revolutionary. What they realized is, look, if you're able to expose these nutrients, can't you then isolate them and extract them and you know, basically produce other nutrients that would be valuable in human consumption. So really was started around a way to make a healthier dextrose. That was the first product we looked at. And so we operated at a pilot scale. Kind of what you have to do is you operate at a pilot scale, then you operate at a demonstration scale, and then you build a commercial plant. So that takes time. So what we did is we found investors that supported the idea that, look, if you can extract a nutrient from something that wouldn't normally be very valuable, there's a really good value proposition there. So that's what the idea, you know, what the company was founded around. We subsequently found that we were producing Arabinose Island. It's not like we went out to say, how do you produce Arabinose Island? It was more, what's resident in this feedstock? And how can we extract it? And so that's how we found that we were producing Arabinose Island, which happens to be a really, really interesting and valuable dietary fiber. But it takes time. You know, you really do have to go through kind of the painful process of scaling up a technology before you can actually go commercial.
So of all the things to grab fiber from, what they started, your founders began with corn stover, which there's gazillions of pounds of corn stover around. Then they switched over to wheat. Tell me that maybe you were there, maybe you were not. Why going this direction?
I was there.
Available?
So when we first looked at this concept of commercialization, we were planning to commercialize on corn stover, but it's not commonly harvested and gathered. Wheat straw is, however. So we'd actually looked at, all right, how do you de-risk this? Well, you can process corn stover, but you could also buy wheat straw because we know you can buy it and we know we can process it. So then we said, well, why don't we just do wheat straw? It was that simple. It's really a better feedstock. There's more arabinose island present, and we're able to tap into the networks that the farmers already use to gather that wheat straw. So it really became a matter of, let's not take risk on the feedstock side, process and the processing side and launching a new product side. Let's eliminate one of the risks. Let's use a product that's already gathered.
So it's kind of at this facility, which is in Denmark now. I've you put the call out. We're up and running. We have a customer base, the chocolate company, beverage company, whatever, and we need to create arabinose island, this derived fiber. And by the way, we're buying straw. If you put that word out, I'm guessing within 4 hours, you'll have semi loads of big square bales of straw. Is that what happens?
It's big square bales of straw, right? So the bigger and denser, you know, they're about half ton bales. So yeah, so our partner who we haven't talked about, it's a company called Miliora, based in Denmark. They have a plant. It's a wheat straw to cellulosic ethanol plant. And so they are already experts kind of in gathering that feedstock. And as they started that plant up, they reached out, you know, through brokers basically to source wheat straw.
They're making ethanol out of wheat straw. And they said, we already have the whole system of getting wheat straw trucked in here and the source. So here, you need a few bales also, is essentially what they did. And so we're not doing ethanol from wheat straw here. Do you see a synergy or offshoot or something, a partnership happening here in the United States?
Yeah. So the really cool thing about what we're doing in Denmark is they had bought this facility. It had been shuttered. And they actually started it back up in 2020 to make ethanol for hand sanitizer. And, you know, the economics of ethanol for transportation fuel are such that, you know, you can get good margins. But if you can also sell a co-product, which in our case, we're buying a co-product from them, that really improves the economics. So yeah, I think there are a ton of synergies with food processing, potentially with ethanol production, really with existing processes. You know, we can buy wheat from farmers, or we can kind of co-locate with a facility where we will buy a co-product and process it. It's kind of the basic stuff ag processors have been doing for hundreds of years.
Yeah, but nobody's been doing this on your website.
No.
On your website, there's the word. I'm gonna go with a whole bunch of questions. By the way, I went to your website. I'm not an expert, but I want to know enough to ask what my listeners are asking. On your website, the word prebiotic is used quite a bit. Yeah. Not probiotic, prebiotic. Explain.
Yeah, you know, it's not a new concept, but it's only started to enter the vernacular relatively recently. So a prebiotic it's just what probiotics eat. So if you eat a yogurt that's got probiotics, these beneficial bacteria, they need to eat something. And what they eat is dietary fiber. So we're the food, you know, prebiotics are the food for probiotics. That's the way to think about it. If you're seeding your stomach, for example, with probiotics, you should feed them something. And what you want to feed them is dietary fiber.
Gut health is a subject that has been big. Not wacky, not anti-GMO, not low carb. It wasn't like that. It was actually because it didn't become goofy, trendy Hollywood stuff. I actually gave it more credence. And maybe you're there with me. The gut health thing seems like it almost plays in the same sandbox as your offering. Am I right about that?
Yeah. So it supports. So this product as a prebiotic supports gut health. It supports a healthy microbiome. Yeah, and I mean, people have been trying to have healthy biome. We just didn't call it that, right? A healthy microbiome. 10, 20 years ago, it was just like, get good dietary fiber because it has lots of health benefits. It turns out a lot of that is because of what it does in the gut.
Yeah. So my whole chocolate milk, sometimes with a scoop of ice cream in it, Nestle Quick, whole milk, ice cream, Nestle Quick in the morning, then a hot dog and homemade sauerkraut. That's like probably when you think about gut health, Mr. Troyer, are you thinking that I'm right there? Because my wife,
I'm thinking you might want to add some dietary fiber to that regimen personally.
Well, and I might
keep eating those foods, but get some dietary fiber.
After I get off of this call, I'm going to probably do that. Okay, now we're going to rapid fire. Well, what are the drawbacks? Let's face it.
Yep.
You've been with this company for, I don't know how long. The company's been around for 8 years.
7 years, yep.
You've been there for what?
7 years,
March. 7 of the 8 years since they started this. It ain't easy. This is not easy. What have you already come? But more importantly, what do you have to overcome for this thing to fly?
Yeah, it's really about launching a new product in food because, you know, there are some really great brands out there and they don't want to take risks.
With new additives?
Exactly. They want to make sure they know what they're doing and they have a process that they go through, right? So our biggest challenge is really navigating that process and the time it takes to go from try the sample, see what you think, test it in the lab, to include this in your product because consumers are going to like it. So that's really because we're not the ones who go direct to consumer. It's really about convincing our customers that this is the right thing to put into their food, their brand they want to protect.
Yeah. And I'm drinking a Coca-Cola right now. God knows, you start tweaking the ingredient list too aggressively. It could be new Coke all over again. So there's that challenge. So that's your challenge. But you're playing into, again, we talk about gut health, talk about reduction of sugar. You're playing into trends that are not fads. I mean, I think there's a difference. Fad was low carb or whatever, you know, the South Beach diet. I don't think you're into a fad. I think you're playing into a trend that stays around for a while. That has to be a strength. And I'm not doing this to blow sunshine up your skirt. It seems like you're playing into the right trend.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's a really long-term trend, which is, hey, people, we've known we needed whole grains for thousands of years, really. And this is just a way to get that nutrition in a more convenient form. So it's definitely not a trend, but it is growing, right? People are much more aware of that importance.
What's interesting, Rich, there was a movement for a long while, and I keep up, you know, I try to read and observe and go to the, you know, Whole Foods and go and watch what farmers market selling, all this. There was a push against processed food for the longest time, the whole obesity thing, we're fat, we're unhealthy, we're sick, whatever. And then the whole COVID thing happened, and all of a sudden, Frosted Flakes and Pop-Tarts and, you know, Kraft mac and cheese flew off the shelves. It had a lot of shelf life and wasn't, you know, not as terribly perishable as fresh stuff. And also as a comfort and convenient thing. So almost like processed food got a shot in the arm the last couple of years. Be interesting to see how that trends out. But your stuff goes into processed foods, which was sort of on the, on the target list. And now it's back to being okay, but like you're a healthier component of processed food. So it'll be interesting how that dynamic plays out. Where do you see it go?
Well, look, I mean, we don't only go into the kind of the highly processed foods. You know, obviously we go to things like beverages that would tend to be less, you know, in that category. But look, it's here to stay. I mean, there's no, you can hope that people will eat grains and veggies and that their diet's going to be meat, grains and veggies. And that's it, but that's just not going to happen. So, you know, I have four kids. They grab stuff from the fridge on the way out, or from our, you know, cabinet. They want the convenient food. So that's not going away anytime. So you might as well make it more healthy, right? That it's really about making health more convenient. That's the benefit we think of adding things like dietary fiber to your food. Well,
while we're talking about business stuff, I want to then talk about downstream stuff. You guys extract arabinoxylin. Extract arabinoxylin and turn it into your proprietary brand, Arabina. And then you've got this leftover stuff. It's straw that's had some process done to it. Where would it go? Will it go? Can it go after you're done with that straw?
Does it
go back to being bedding for a cow?
No. So in the current plant where we're co-located, what happens is they take, so there are three components of, you know, in any biomass, it's the hemicellulose. We take the hemicellulose. We, you know, purify that into the Arapahoe Island. Then you've got cellulose and you've got lignin. So in the example of our plant that we're, you know, our partnership, they take the cellulose and they produce ethanol out of it. And then the lignin that remains for now actually goes back to a boiler where we recover basically the energy value and make steam. So it's, you know, it's kind of that classic circular economy thing that people talk about. But right now the lignin, we're getting basically the energy value out of the lignin, but lots
okay,
of.
So you've got the fiber that you're going to use for a food ingredient. You've got the, one of the byproducts, the lignin is going to go to creation of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And you can even play the green energy card on that. Where's the other stuff go?
The cellulose goes, it's treated enzymatically. And then it's basically brewed into ethanol and then distilled. So they're producing transportation grade cellulosic ethanol.
But you do that. That goes down the street to another place.
Right.
And that's then the steam, the lignin going in the steam, does that go down the street also, or does that stay on site?
Yeah. So actually it does go down the street. We buy our steam. There's a centralized boiler. Oh. Basically, they produce steam and power, and they use biomass. So they're using the lignin.
Okay. It seems to me right now, 8 years in, the company's now getting rolling. You're not profitable yet, right?
Correct. Yep.
Okay. How far away?
It's not far at all. So this is, you know, the beautiful thing about this is because we're taking something that from a kind of value per ton is relatively low. So if you think about wheat straw, you know, call it on a dry basis, just for argument's sake, call it $100 a ton.
Okay.
And then our product sells for, you know, in the neighborhood of $10 to $15 per kilo. So 500, you know, you're basically taking a relatively low cost feedstock and producing something that will sell in the order in the magnitude of $10,000 per ton. So it's just that it's upgrading to higher value. So once, you know, at this facility, we can produce 4,000 tons. That's very, very profitable.
By the way,
really, I love your profitability.
Yeah. And there's somebody listening right now that grows wheat and bale straw in, you know, Kansas is saying $100 a ton. Hell, almost sell for 70, whatever. You just pointed out that for argument's sake, but the main,
it's for argument's sake. Yeah.
For the picture here is we just 100 times, isn't that what we did? We 100 times the value of something.
Yeah, that seems like that's the math. Yeah. Now, obviously, there are energy inputs. You've got to do things.
So my big picture here is to that wheat farmer in Kansas, and I hear this a lot, and I'm a defender of ag, but I also am a guy that holds up the mirror and gives them a reel. If you want to sell your wheat straw for more, put in this plant, spend 8 years doing what Comet Bio is doing to add the value. Well, I don't want to do that. Exactly. So that's why your straw is worth $70 to $100 a ton. But after you go through 8 years of this kind of slog, you're going to turn it into something that's, you know, got 100 times that value. So it's exciting stuff. What's the potential? I mean, like, where does this go?
So the market for dietary fiber today, and I'm talking about just as an ingredient, not kind of the food, the dietary fiber you get naturally, just as a separate ingredient, it's about 1 million metric tons a year, which is pretty big. The average price of dietary fibers, you know, let's just say again, for argument's sake, people have different views, $5. So it's a $5 billion market opportunity, and it's growing faster than plant-based protein, as an example. It's one of the fastest growing ingredients categories in the world. So it's growing at about 10 to 15%, and that's actually accelerating. So it's a massive opportunity. You're talking hundreds of thousands of new tons per year. Mm-hmm. So it's huge. You know, we're producing 4,000 metric tons, and looking and selling that into a market that's well over 1,000 metric tons, growing at 100,000 metric tons a year. So it's a massive, you know, when you look at food ingredients, there aren't a lot of huge growth opportunities. This is one of the few.
Yeah. Processing happens in Denmark starting right now. Mm-hmm. You're a multinational company. You've got facilities in Ontario, mm-hmm. Canada, and then you are talking to me from an office in Schaumburg, Illinois. Are we going to have a processing facility in North America anytime soon?
Yes. So we like to say we're small, but global. We are all over the place. we do need to build a plant in North America. So we're looking today at where do we go next? Because we are selling in the U.S., the regulatory regime here allows us to sell this product today here in the U.S. So we're actually transporting from Denmark to the U.S. Mm-hmm. That's not the most logical thing to do long term. So we will build a plant here in North America. And then the plant in Denmark is going to be great for serving the European market.
Okay, now, I'm sorry, Rich, but if there are three ethanol plants within 30 miles of where I'm sitting here at my farm in Indiana, because ethanol, corn weighs 56 pounds a bushel. Okay, yep. So trucking corn to make ethanol. So do you need to be where the straw is? Are you going to be, are you going to locate a plant in Kansas, I think, is still the number one wheat state. It might be North Dakota right now. Either way, it's going to be one of those plain states or possibly up in the inland northwest in the Palouse of Washington. Where are you going to go?
Yeah, so it's going to be something like a Kansas, North Dakota, or Canada. That basically where you grow wheat, that's where it's got to be, because the transportation, it's much more economical to produce this high value ingredient and then transport that than it is obviously to transport the wheat straw in the first place. Huge amount of the economics is driven by the transportation cost.
We're not going to be trucking. We're not going to be trucking big square bales of straw into Schaumburg just because it's convenient for you. The processing facility is going to be where the wheat is.
Exactly.
Got it. Last couple of questions for you. What scares you? You've been running this company. You've been there for 7 years. What concerns you?
It's kind of the question you asked, which is, when are you building a plant in North America? And I've learned to be much more humble about predicting the timing. So what worries me is always, how long is this going to take, right, to get it to the place we want it to be? Learn to be humble on predicting timing. So really, it's about, you know, how long is this going to take to commercialize? And then I will tell you, we're starting, you know, we've been starting up our plant. So on the day-to-day, what worries me, it's like, well, hey, this batch looks really good, but not quite as good as the one we produced yesterday. And how do we make sure we get consistent product? But it's so, kind of basic stuff, you know.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I drink Coors. There's a hell of a lot of consistency from one can of Coors that I drank last night to the one I had a year ago, because they've been cranking that stuff out since the 1800s out of Golden, Colorado. You've been cranking out stuff for a week, month, two months, whatever. So consistency is one of the struggles at first because of scale.
Correct. So that's what we, you know, our team is putting in the hours to make sure, you know, we can prove to our customers, boom, 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 here are five runs and they look exactly the same. So that's kind of the blocking and tackling stuff that we think about and worry about today.
Do you see a grill? This is my last couple here. This is something that excites me and most people in ag, because it's a new marketplace. Granted, it's not huge. We're not going to gobble up every ton of straw off of every acre on all 47 million wheat acres in the United States of America, and however many millions there are in the, you know, the provinces, the Western province of Canada. But it is a new market. Yep. Is this grow? Not just with you. Are we going to see more of this?
Yeah, look, I think so talking specifically about our product, with the North American plant, we have the ability to drive this down to a very, very low cost of production, where you can go after a lot of the existing dietary fibers. For example, inulin is generally imported from Europe. So our goal is to basically make dietary fiber here. So it can be pretty big. You're right. It's not going to be like corn ethanol, probably, in terms of size. For the farmers, for the producers where we're located, it can significantly improve farming economics. So, you know, this is a market that's growing massively. And I just think it's going to continue to do that.
That's exciting. And by the way, saying it can't be as big as corn ethanol, first off, there's a reason that 36% or 7% of the corn goes into ethanol, and it's because of the renewable fuel standard that was a government decree. There's no government stipulation that a food company has to use your stuff, right?
Nope.
Yeah.
Correct. It's to the consumers. It's all about if the consumers want it or not. If they want it, we'll sell it. If they don't want it, they're not going to buy it.
Or if the food company sees a competitive advantage in doing so. And that probably is what you're pitching also.
Well, yeah, they have to believe that their consumers will ultimately buy it.
Sure.
Buy it as well. Yep.
All right. Get me out of here, Rich Troyer. What else do I need to know? CEO of Comet Bio.
No, I think that's it. It's, you know, we are scaling up today, and I'd say look for Arabina at a store near you in the not too distant future.
But it's going to be in a product. You're going to have to search through it. So will you come back in a few years and give us the update?
Absolutely. Hopefully by then we'll have a North American plant we can talk about.
Got it. So if you want to learn more about this, because I find it interesting, and I'm sure you do too, if you're a listener to the Business of Agriculture, you're smart and you want to know what's coming. And that's what I try to bring you. So the company's called Comet Bio. Again, the website?
Comet-Bio or -Bio, depending on your preference.
His name is Rich Troyer. My name is Damian Mason. If you like what you heard here, remember there's 310 past episodes of the Business of Agriculture. It's available wherever you get your audio podcasts, SoundCloud, Spotify, etc. You know what else? It's a show because we sit here and you get to see people like us talk. It's on my YouTube channel, Damian Mason channel. Just go on YouTube and subscribe. It's free, Damian Mason channel. It's also on Acres TV. Watch Acres TV. That's it. Watch Acres TV. Type it in your browser and it's there as well. Please show somebody that can benefit from it. If you like what we're doing at Business of Agriculture, you might also like all the cool content I'm creating over at Extreme Ag. Remember Extreme Ag, my progressive, forward-thinking farmers doing really cool stuff, doing bunches of interviews, hundreds of videos featuring me and what the Extreme Ag guys are doing at extremeag.farm. That's X with no E on the front of extremeag.farm. Till next time, thanks for being here, Mr. Troyer.
Thanks, Damian.
I'm Damian Mason, and this is the Business of Agriculture. Hey, thanks for being here. This episode of the Business of Agriculture was brought to you by Pattern Ag. You've heard me talk about Pattern Ag because I think it's a pretty cool concept. New technology that allows you to predict the problems you're going to have and therefore treat them before those problems cost you money. What kind of problems am I talking about? Pests and disease. Things like corn rootworm, sudden death syndrome, cyst nematode, and a whole bunch of other bad things that happen out there in the field that can cost you money. Guess what? Pattern Ag will let you find out ahead of time if the disease or the pest pressure is there, and therefore you're treating it before it costs you any money. What a great concept. Go to pattern.ag, that's www.pattern.ag, to learn more about their product, their technology, how it can make you money, save you yield, and also where you can find a rep that can come out there and do the work for you. Pattern.ag.